Amandalai Wethu. My name is Douglas. This is Honoring the Baobab Tree, Bridging the African Diaspora. This is an experiment and exploration of identity. Identity for anybody who moves through life as a Black or African person. The thing is, we often have little to no knowledge about our traditional cultural heritage and no clue where to begin exploring. We live our lives in societies developed with intrinsic hatred and bias against us despite our level of assimilation, accomplishment in education, or so-called success in a career. This podcast is for us, for any self-identifying Black or African person. See, if we move through life with an identity and values that are foreign and threaten our very existence, we limit our capacity to achieve the possibilities we are destined for. To those who are interested in hearing perspectives, ideas, ways of being that are not given a platform or have been devalued in our society, welcome. So I see our guests have entered in. Our co-host Tina is in the space, and so is Ahmed. So if y'all go ahead and call in, we can go ahead and get started with the introductions. So I already used a couple of some language that, you know, whenever we speak in this podcast, it's really important for us to clarify the language that we're using and make sure our listeners understand what we're saying. So I use a couple of words. I use the word diaspora. So that's in our title, you know, Bridging the African Diaspora. So if you don't know what diaspora means, it simply means the dispersion of any people from their original homeland. So, you know, diaspora means, so if you come from, if you're a Black or African person and you live outside of Africa, you're part of a diaspora, meaning you're part of a larger community outside of your original homeland. And also part of the title that should be explained is the Baobab tree. Now, so this tree, the reason that this tree has been included in the title is that it there's significance in the Baobab tree. So if you don't know what the tree looks like, I highly recommend y'all going in, Google Baobab tree, and you spell it B-A-O-B-A-B. So there's spiritual significance in this tree, there's social significance, and there's some symbolism. The spiritual significance in Western African culture is that many times as elders pass away, they are buried under these trees. And these trees are a sign of spirituality in the sense that the continuation of life and the connection of the local people to these trees and their ability to continuously visit their ancestors. The social significance of these trees is that it is a community gathering space. So people of the community come together to sit around and exchange information. As we know, that African people are rely on the oral tradition, so that they gather around these trees and exchange information, tell stories, give the latest news or updates about what's going on. And then finally is the symbolism of the Baobab tree. The symbolism is that this tree grows in a space where it is dry and arid, yet it stands strong and stands tall for years and years and years. So with that, I want to pass the floor to my co-host here, Tina, to let her introduce herself. What's up, Tina?
Hello. Can you all hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right, cool. I just wanted to make sure. Hello, my name is Tina Okoye. I am absolutely happy to be co-hosting this awesome event for the Pan-African Student Collective. And I'm really happy that you brought up the Baobab tree, because I, being West African, specifically Nigerian, that it is a very important symbolic entity. And it's also really useful in terms of different types of cosmetics like shea butter, lotions, powders. So it is more than just community building. It's literally part of our, you know, our skin, our body. It literally overall just keeps us healthy. So I'm so happy you brought that up, and I'm really looking forward to these conversations today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Tina. And with that, I would like to introduce our first guest. So we're going to be having guests on these episodes with us. And this is Ahmed. So Ahmed, how you doing, bro? Are you with us? Oh, wait, I see him. I got you, Ahmed. Oh. Ahmed, how you doing?
Hello?
You're in. You're live.
Good.
How you doing?
Good. Hello? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we hear you.
I'm good. How are you doing?
Good. Welcome.
Nice.
Yeah, so go ahead and introduce
yourself. Thanks for having me. Oh, yeah. Hi, my name is Ahmed Fogi. I teach in the geography department here at HSU. I teach geospatial concepts as well as a class on professionalism, which looks at a book on reform in the California state prison system. And in the spring of this next semester, I'll be doing a class on transatlantic studies.
Dope. So, Ahmed, how long? Okay, so awesome. I should have gone ahead and said we are all, this is a production of Humboldt State University. We are all in some way connected to Humboldt State University. I am the Black Cultural Center coordinator. And Tina, you want to talk about what you do on campus?
Yes. So I am currently the student retention specialist here at Humboldt State, you know, just trying to find best practices and strategic methods on how to better retain our students, but also help them matriculate so they're able to navigate school or navigate life after college.
Yep. Cool. So let's jump into this conversation here. Again, I sort of talked about in the intro, talked about the whole purpose of this, you know, really being like a space for us to, you know, be a launching off point for people who identify as Black or African, right? And being a space for us to, right. When we go through school, we go through education. There's really not a space for us to learn about ourselves. Right. And I kind of, you know, I would jump into Ahmed to your paper that we're kind of looking at here, that came out earlier this year. You have a quote, Ahmed. I'm gonna start with this quote though. And I kind of want to hear your thoughts and Tina follow, feel free to chime in, but Ahmed, you have a quote in your paper and it says, quote, "A population that lacks knowledge of its history is easier to manipulate and is thus more susceptible to exploitation as free or cheap labor for bourgeoning empires." So can you break that down for a minute? What is like, I sort of talked about that in the introduction, but what, as far as when, and you're talking about the transatlantic, maybe talk about what we mean by transatlantic, and why you decided to focus on that, but where does this fall in line with that?
Okay, yeah. So first of all, when referring to the transatlantic, what I'm talking about is the study of the regions that border the Atlantic Ocean. So West Africa, the western part of Europe, the eastern part of North America and South America, and of course the Caribbean. And so specifically what I'm talking about is the notion of what happens to a people when they are enslaved, which is the case of what happened to those of African descent. They were pulled and brought here as the labor force and were intentionally kept uneducated. Not that we must often remember that these people were educated where they came from, but over time, over centuries, they are easy to manipulate and to put into spaces that they may not like, because they don't realize that there is something bigger, that they do come from something more than that. And that's what I was kind of hinting at. And like I said, the best case for that is those who are descended of African slaves, who are descended of the diaspora. People with no knowledge of self lack no center to kind of base themselves up off of. But yeah, so that's what I was referring to.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for filling that in. Tina, do you have anything to follow up with that?
I actually wanted to, I think that quote is so powerful because as the article continues to go on, I'm actually trying to find the part right now, but I can basically summarize it. I just find it so ironic because I know that there was a period of time where, African slaves were actually helping some of these, or a lot of these oppressors, and just in terms of how for them to plant like rice, like it seemed like they had so many skills that actually ended up ironically helping the oppressors. So when it's just like I don't know what you think about this, Ahmed, but please, I would like to hear a comment on it. How do you feel about knowing that there have been African slaves who decided to, you know, help these oppressors, knowing that these oppressors had no intention on helping these African slaves? Like, how do you feel about that? Like, what encouraged you to put that in your paper?
Let me dissect that a little bit. So,
okay.
what had me put that in my paper was the idea, the notion that African slaves were ignorant. Mm-hmm. I think that's a misconception that has prevailed for centuries, that Africans had no sense of knowledge of how to do anything. They were just a bunch of savages running around the Sahara, which, you know, we all know is not true. And so that's kind of why I started with that. But the way I feel about those people who helped them is kind of kind of a mixed bag, right? I mean, some of them were helping because they had no choice, you know, by being forced to work. Let me help you out. And then others were helping because they kind of saw people who were, trying to think of the best way to put it, they were ignorant to the practices of how to tend to this land. The reason that Africans were chosen in the first place is because the ecosystem of the American South and of the Caribbean is similar to West Africa. So they knew how to work the land like that already. They had that knowledge. And so when the Europeans kind of come and take them over, they have no idea what they're doing. There's this kind of also this, another misconception that Europeans pioneers were like these ingenious people who like came to this land and knew exactly what to do. It's also false. They had no idea what they were doing. And they needed someone to kind of guide them. And so in some cases, they went to the natives who are already in this land. And in some cases, they referred to their Africans to help them. And like I said, it realized that these people, I mean, so many American practices that we have now and notions of kind of come from West Africa, notions of voodoo and healing methods that came from African healers who themselves were enslaved because of kind of other eternal tribal conflicts. This is an educated mass in some cases who come over here, who are forced over here. And that's something that's key, that's paramount to me, is that, you know that you come from smart people. Don't forget that. Don't let people tell you that you don't. Because you do.
There's actually two really big things that you brought up in your response, Ahmed, and that's first, I think the first part is, you know, well, I think, let me back up. Going back to your quote about, you know, when we lack our history and we're easier to manipulate, I keep coming to this thing, okay, so if we don't know our history, if we aren't in touch with our cultural heritage, right, if we're disassociated from some of our traditional cultural values, that void isn't exactly empty. Right, that void of knowledge is not—it's not empty. Meaning that the knowledge that we once held has been replaced with something else. Right, it's been replaced with another type of knowledge, another type of perspective, another type of way of being, another way of viewing our and understanding ourselves. And sort of like in my introduction, how I was saying, like everything that those things that have replaced our knowledge of self is detrimental to is inherently detrimental. Right, because as you described in this article, which I think we're going to get access to the students so that they can tap into this, is that, you know, as you mentioned, I met very smart people, right? So we're first of all, knowing this history, knowing that we came from people who were masters of their environment, right? They were masters of their environment. They could manipulate the environment to do what they needed to do to survive, and then also that. I think we can touch on this later, but the idea that, you know, again, the negative stereotypes about the people who were enslaved, our ancestors, right? They were running around sub-Saharan Africa chasing lions and stuff like that. And really, these are people who were, again, masters of their environment, and they were not a docile people, right? As we will look at when we talked about Haiti, but they were. They practice resistance in all sorts of fashion, right? So I think just touching on that and bringing that to the surface of our thought is important.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always whenever I even the notion of so let's put it like this: Columbus comes to the Americas in 1492, right? So 1400s. So. Think about, like, I don't know if you two are familiar with the story of Mansa Musa. Mansa Musa was a king from Mali. This is like in the 1200s. And this he's a Muslim, and so he takes a pilgrimage to Mecca across Africa. And his wealth was so immense at the time that he literally broke the economy of the world at the time. One person, one king, one ruler. He was so wealthy that he is mentioned in European European maps of the time. They mentioned Mansa Musa and what he did in Timbuktu. He was richer than those in Europe at the time. I bring up things like this because, again, people are aware, but they're not really aware. And again, they were warriors, they were kings, there were landscapes littered West Africa of great kingdoms. And now what is left is relics. But we must not forget that that's what was there. And this forced labor that they get when they come into the Caribbean over time, that is forgotten because those people die out, their children mm-hmm. go on, and then nothing is passed down. But certain things are passed down. Certain notions, because we realize West Africa, they believe in the oral tradition. Mm-hmm. So things are passed down orally. Certain mm-hmm. stories and certain cultural practices are passed down. Mm-hmm. But that larger narrative is kind of taken away because it kind of gets mixed in with what the Europeans are telling them. And so over time, you start to lose that identity and you start to cultivate a new one. And that's the unfortunate side, because those new identities tend to just want to shrink away from that mm-hmm. old identity when in fact it does have that.
Yeah, I think that's it.
So I kind of want to shift mm-hmm. a little bit. Oh, you got something there?
Go for it.
Yeah, because I really do feel you in the fact that it's almost like you know things, like you become aware that, yeah, of course, Black people are amazing, we're smart, like, look at our history, but how do we actually execute that knowledge? How do we still continue that empowerment without just hearing it, if that makes sense? And I think about that a lot, because I'm like, I know we're an amazing people. I know that we have a lot to offer and we've offered a lot. And yet there is still this feeling of, I guess it is helplessness really, because then you watch the news or you're hearing another policy being created that just continues to keep us down. So like, how do we continuously stay empowered? How do we continuously, remember that we're more worthy than the horrible past of slavery. Like, how do we do that? How do we, I always just think about that, and I wonder if you have thoughts on that.
I do. I mean, and I guess this is where my bias as an academic comes in, I think. Mm. But it is the constant conversation. Don't let them take it away from you. A friend of mine was talking to this, and this may sound kind of off subject and tangential, but a friend of mine was talking, we were talking about depictions of Black people in fiction, and how they said that they were tired of seeing Black people, getting beaten in a fictional show or having racist notions brought up against them in television shows. And on one hand, yeah, I agree, because that is tiring. But the reason why that must be pervasive is because if you forget about it, then you're going to lose that drive that you were speaking of. And I was speaking specifically about the show that's currently on HBO called Lovecraft, which takes place in the Jim Crow era. And you have Black heroes kind of dealing with racism while also dealing with horrible monsters in H.P. Lovecraft. And it's kind of, the show asks the question, what's worse, racism or monsters? And honestly, one's real and one's a fantasy. So, but that is my whole notion on it. You don't forget. So I strive to do programs like this, where people, we can kind of share this information amongst ourselves and spread it to other people. Because once you lose that kernel of truth, once it starts to slip, because we must also remember that while a minority of us is kind of aware of these things, maybe the majority isn't. And I think about that a lot too when I kind of see things on the news, things like that. Majority of people are not, and that ignorance isn't always their fault. And if it's not, what can we do to bring that knowledge to them? Is how I think.
Let me follow up on that, because okay, I'm gonna quote you again in your paper, bro. So you wrote at the last sentence in this paper is, quote, remaining oblivious to dynamics and forces that gave rise to the transatlantic world. As a historical geographic region, we are likely to sit by as the cycles of subjugation and insurrection repeat themselves. And so, kind of tapping into what you're saying, I'm at the point personally where I think, because I've been privileged enough to gain some of this knowledge and tap into this knowledge, that when I see, you know, 2020, the things that we have going on in our community, I call it a genocide, right? State-sponsored genocide in our country. When I see these things taking place, and we have some of the responses as a community to these things, for me personally, like the responses just don't go far enough, right? I still see a settling. We're still asking for permission. Yeah. We're still going through these channels of which, right? I think for me personally, it's like if our people really tap into these dynamics and forces, that you get fed up quicker. You get fed up. You don't think of this as like, oh, this is a new occurrence, or this has only been happening since the 60s, right? No, this has been happening for centuries. And I think, honestly, not being disassociated from that information is detrimental to ourselves, to our own community, to ourselves. So, I mean, that's just sort of how I feel about it. Yeah, we got to stay tapped into this information. And as we gain it, you know, put it out there for people to also absorb and tap into. Ahmed, you actually brought up two things in your paper that tap into like sort of like pop culture or contemporary culture, right? Of how we communicate through art. And you mentioned the transatlantic's influence on two subcultures, right? But definitely so. You mentioned hip hop, right? So the transatlantic's influence on hip hop, and also the transatlantic's influence on the development of skinhead culture. So oftentimes people think skinhead, and it's the first thing that people think of skinhead, they think neo-Nazi, right? But really that is the origin of skinhead. Would you mind going ahead and breaking that down a little bit, Ahmed, and giving the listeners some like a little bit of information on that?
Absolutely. And I will say that that story began for me years ago when I was watching a movie called This Is Ancient, which is about the split and skinhead culture between the neo-Nazis and the non-neo-Nazis. Let me pull back some pathways here. So as we are probably well aware, Jamaica was once upon a time a British colony. It was a vast sugar producing colony for the British Empire. Well, over time, you know, Jamaica gains independence and the British Empire becomes the British Commonwealth. And that means that technically Jamaica still is under the jurisdiction of the Queen of England to this day. So what that means is Jamaican immigrants, when they leave Jamaica, they tend to go to two places. They go to New York or they go to England. And so in the 70s, you saw, 60s and 70s, you saw this massive movement of Jamaicans into London. Mostly because after the Second War and things like that, there were opportunities that they saw that they could take in. So they did. But what they bring with them is their music. They bring reggae with them, obviously. And they bring this to the streets of working class Londoners. And, you know, instead of necessarily growing their hair on dreads, they would cut their hair very low. What we now call it a brush cut or a dark season. They would cut their hair down like that. They would wear Doc Martin boots, and they would put on polo shirts, and they called themselves skinheads. They listened to reggae. And over time, the white working class population of England began to adopt this culture as well. And so you kind of get this amalgamation of those like working class white people and the Jamaican people kind of coming together to form this culture. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with the genre of music called ska. This is a combination of and reggae, because again, these people were hanging out together. Now, what happens is, in the 1980s, there's a conservative prime minister takes power in England. Their name is Margaret Thatcher. And the British working class feels kind of the hurts of being under a conservative government. And this radicalizes those working class white people, which may sound kind of familiar today. And they start to adopt more kind of nationalistic tendencies, England for the English, and things like that. Now, they'd already adopted the skinhead culture. They still liked the music. They just kind of didn't want other people coming into England anymore. And so over time, you get this split where the skinheads start to lean more into this national identity and less into this kind of cultural identity. And now, I mean, once the skinhead culture makes its way to America, that original notion is completely dead. And that sometimes, oftentimes, I mean, my mind goes to those Jamaicans who were part of that culture originally. And, you know, you got this notion that it's like, well, do I hold on to this identity or do I hold on to my integrity? And why should I have to do either? But unfortunately, I do now. So that was kind of what I was hitting at there with that skinhead culture. Because again, culture, I consider myself a cultural historian. And culture has a way of kind of diffusing and spreading. And it doesn't really adhere to our notions of boundaries and things like that. It's just, you like what you like. And it just kind of spreads like that. But this is England also. And also there's another movie recently that came out about this too. It's called Farming. It's a scripted movie, but it's also about this notion of black people and skinhead culture as well. I haven't seen it yet, but I hear good.
Oh, what's it called? Farming.
Farming.
Oh, farming.
Yeah, the notion of like farming out someone. It's about like a young, like kind of, I think, I want to say he's Nigerian. I think it's a true story. A Nigerian immigrant who's farmed out to an English family. They say he goes to England and he kind of gets immersed in this culture as well.
Mm. Oh, wow. I need to go check that out.
Yeah, that's pretty dope. Yeah, I think I had learned about the skinhead culture coming originating from Jamaica and Jamaican immigrants, and I was like just totally blown away because, you know, skinhead has become something like, it's so offensive, right? It's like a threat when someone says skinhead or you see a skinhead. It's, you know, mm-hmm. But, you know, again, I think just going back into like that idea of just how creative of people that we are, you know, and how influential we are across the world. You know what I'm saying? And I think that gets so cliche, people hearing us say that, like people hear black people say that a lot, right? But being able to look around these different cultures and identifying our imprint on these cultures is empowering, mm-hmm. you know? So, yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, because you brought up the notion of diaspora at the beginning, and that is, that spread, right? It's a people, but it's also a culture. It's constantly moving around. And that's when I talk about neutral or transatlantic, I'm really only talking about, West Africa, but kind of the East African side of it. That's a whole other story, which I won't go into, obviously, because that's not my area of expertise. But again, it's kind of, it is fascinating. Can't stop, won't stop. That's not supportive. I won't say that.
Yeah, so, okay, so I think you gotta tap in. So you followed up, you talked about Haiti and Jamaica and, skinhead. Tap in, if Tina, you don't have anything, tap in with, you know, the transatlantic's influence on hip hop. I think that one might be kind of obvious, but I think it's still worth exploring and talking about.
Absolutely. And that one is massive to me, just because the cultural effect that hip hop has around the world now. And this actually harkens back to something I said earlier about that kind of, some things get passed down and some things are cultural traditions. And so in a lot of regions in West Africa, when you are kind of summoning a spirit or doing some type of healing exercise, a drum circle and dancing comes together, right? These kind of West African drum beats, right? So over time, you know, you get slaves coming into the Caribbean, and they're passing this down. They're passing down these drum beats, like these drum beats and things like that. And so this is all over the Caribbean too, but you bring up Jamaica specifically, because in Jamaica you kind of get the rise of dance hall music and things like that. And well, those Jamaican immigrants will eventually take that to New York, to the Bronx, and then you give that to some up-and-coming DJs who already are trying to mess around with music due to kind of new equipment and new musical technology, and you get the birth of hip hop, and it's beautiful because now it is this huge cultural phenomenon. But again, this is kind of that soft culture getting passed around over time. Yeah. It's that diffusion. It never really goes away. I mean, I didn't talk about this in the paper, but you find the same thing kind of in the American blues, kind of in the banjo, and don't you think that? I mean, that's a West African instrument as well. So much of American music, what we call American music, I mean, jazz, hip hop, the blues, I mean, that is kind of the remnants of those who were enslaved, who came over. Our kind of cultural influence on this country is, I think that most people don't believe. Sometimes I talk about, I know I'm kind of digressing, but even Southern hospitality is a combination of West African culture combining with British Victorian culture and boom, that notion of Southern hospitality. Yeah. But again, culturally speaking, America is so African that most people would be surprised. It just is. We were here when this country was founded. And although we didn't sign the Declaration of Independence or sign the Constitution, we built it just as much as anybody other group was here at a certain time. We are as significant as they are, if not more, in certain aspects. And that's something that I want to keep stressing to people. And I could talk about other kind of, not really get to Marcus Garvey.
Okay. Well, I have a question in terms of, because obviously you're really passionate about this type of work, but I guess I'm curious as to like what is, and I know you really do like the hip hop, you really like talking about hip hop and where it originated from, but I guess I'm just curious, like, what is your favorite part about the work that you do? Like, in talking about transatlantic, the transatlantic, what specific topic or culture is real, like, that you find the most interesting? Or that's one question. And the second one is, like, what part would you like to know more about?
I guess the part that I find the most interesting is the notion of revolution, which I know may sound odd, but realize that once upon a time in the transatlantic world, there we refer to it as the age of revolution. And what kind of happens is revolution starts, a revolutionary movement starts in the American colonies. We all know that story. It's, you know, what we celebrate in 4th of July. But those pathways make their way to France, which start the French Revolution. But then that makes its way down to Haiti. And that will start a revolution that, in my opinion, is more important than the three of them, because it is a slave revolt that is successful. And it is really the last time in recent history that that's happened, and it worked. And it's kind of a big deal to me. And so that is kind of where my passion lies specifically. As far as things that I want to know more about, this is going to sound totally kind of off the cuff, but I kind of looking at the notions of ethnic identity in general. And so you'll see a lot of what I like to look at specifically is kind of how the Europeans colonized and then how they kind of intermixed in with the native population and then how the African population mixed in too. Because when you start to break that down and dissect it, you start to kind of see that we are more alike than we are different. And notions of kind of Americanness and things like that are kind of ridiculous, really. I mean, if you take that back to the first kind of colonial group to colonize here is the Spanish. But if you go and look at Spanish history and peek at it, you'll see that Spain was once a colony of Africa and North Africa twice in history, which makes you start wondering, ethnically speaking, what exactly is a Spaniard? So that's kind of what I want to know more about, because I just, and I recently tumbled into this because I was looking into, I don't know if you guys are familiar with Hannibal, the kind of leader who took elephants into the Alps.
Yeah.
But I just realized that Carthage controlled what is now the Iberian Peninsula some centuries before the Moors will take it over. And I was like, so it's been colonized twice. So that's kind of, and that's transatlantic, that's proto-transatlantic is what I've been calling it with some colleagues recently. So this is the proto-transatlantic. I hope that answered your questions. I know that was kind of all over the place.
Yeah. No. That was awesome. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, in terms of like just ethnic identity, that is really fascinating because there has been a lot of mixing and, you know, because history typically is told by the victor, not necessarily the, quote unquote loser. We do miss that idea of like this place has been colonized like 3 or 4 times and we had no idea. So like what does it, and then, you know, most identities are socially constructed. It's just people making stuff up to just divide us more. So it is really, that is really fascinating. And if there's an opportunity to learn about that, that would be cool.
Absolutely. And that will be kind of my next project. Well, after I do some other things, like I said, I want to, Haiti is a special, I know I keep going back to it, but it's so fascinating to me. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with C.L.R. James. Mm-hmm. He was a historian and a scholar in the early part of the 20th century. And he wrote a book called The Black Jacobins. Mm-hmm. And he basically was kind of the first historian to link the notion of the Haitian Revolution to the French Revolution. Mm-hmm. Because for so long, it was viewed as an anomaly. It's like, well, how did this happen? And C.L.R. James is like, well, because the slaves were paying attention. That's how it happened. They saw something was happening. And so they kind of capitalized on that moment. They were smarter than the people realized. And that's kind of the unfortunate thing, is that people thought that they were so ignorant that the notion of them rising up just seemed comical at the time. They're like, and so because of that, it does hold a special place. And I'm going to stop talking about Haiti because it's clearly like it's a subject for me.
I think Haiti is a great thing to talk about and explore because, again, just going through education, and this is what we're almost at time here, but just going through our education as Black students, if you grow up in the United States and the education you get about Black people, it really doesn't, you know, your history starts at slavery in the United States, right? So, you know, you're already starting at a negative self-imagery here. And in the way they talk about slavery in American schools is, you know, again, it's not endearing to the slaves, right? It's very, talking about them as if they're children, right? And I think for me, as I got to be an adult and really explore some of these, specifically Haiti, because I think Haiti is a great example of empowerment, right? Here is a country, current day country that struggles, right? And I think that people look around like, well, why does Haiti struggle? Why do these countries struggle? And people, you know, they often prescribe it to some of the negative imagery and negative narratives are, you know, just generally around Black people. Some of these same things we learn in school, right? But we're not really unpacking like the legacy of, Haiti is an island where they overthrew their white slave owners. So you talked about it in your article, the rest of the world pretty much iced them out, right? Iced them out of the global economy, iced them out of, you know, of any kind of global support, international support. And you know, they're left to, the economy, which was a primary producer economy, meaning they produced the goods, but didn't have the infrastructure to take it from like a plant to a finished product. So anyway, I'm going to digress and stop, but I think Haiti is a great example for us as Black people to look at as far as like the possibilities, right? Because oftentimes, you know, if we're stuck at, you know, we just had to accept sort of our situation here. We had to accept some of the things that happened to us, you know, when history doesn't really explore or give us the opportunity to see examples of our people resisting. I think that resistance piece is very important because oftentimes it's just like, oh, docile people, they were enslaved, they're docile, they're begging for freedom, da 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 da. But what about I think the resistance piece is a crucial element that, again, for our students and as a community of people, that having these examples is a sense of empowerment. I'm gonna stop there. I feel you on the Haiti. I really think it's a powerful topic. So check this out.
Absolutely, and don't forget that. I was just gonna bring up the fact that Frederick Douglass for years used Haiti as he brought it up in all the speeches. He would constantly bring it up, Frederick Douglass. He would just say, look at what they did in Haiti. It was a point of pride for him because although it was a struggling republic, it was still a republic. And that says a lot to like kind of one of the greatest black orators of his day. Looked at Haiti and essentially said, hey guys, you know, this is a thing that I want to keep talking about because the legacy of Haiti is something that reverberated back to America. Remember how I said, you know, that revolutionary age starts in America, goes to France, then goes to Haiti. Frederick Douglass kind of picked up the reins and brought it back to the USA, essentially, and said, and then he realized, you know, Frederick Douglass is a contemporary of people like John Brown and Nat Turner, Harriet Tubman. They're all contemporaries of each other. So realize they all saw Haiti. Haiti was big news when it happened. Big news. And they all kind of paid attention. They were like, oh, wow.
So we're pretty much at time here. I think this was a really amazing conversation. And I think actually this is starting off the podcast, I think talking about, you know, being black people in the United States, I think that the transatlantic and having that geographical area in our focus and on our mind, on our radar as a point of exploration is very important because it leads to so many different aspects in our history that, again, that really don't get explored. And you know, in a lot of the educational institutions that we attend. So I think this is a great launching off point. We do have, we will have available for any listeners, we will have Ahmed's article, his commentary on titled Why the Transatlantic, available for students to participate and read. And again, just kind of launch off your exploration and your journey. Before we close out, Ahmed and Tina, do y'all have any final things to say?
I just want to say thank you guys for having me. It's been a blast, and just don't stop learning. I guess is don't stop asking questions. Is really don't stop asking questions.
And I was just gonna say, Ahmed, thank you so much for engaging with us and just having really important and necessary conversations that like center, like, you know, our history centering around blackness and why the work, like why all the work that we've done is so important. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah. And also another thing, Ahmed, it's great for us, you know, to get together like this, even though we're virtual right now, we can't really get together in person. Also for our students, you know, to know who you are on campus, right? You're a resource to our black students. To our black campus community. And so all of us, you know, tapping in and staying in contact with each other is in a lot of ways is revolutionary. So I appreciate y'all tapping in and being a part of this. And I look forward to future conversations.
Yeah, likewise.
All right, family. I appreciate y'all. Until next time.
Absolutely.
All right. Peace.
All right. Sounds good. Peace.